Welcome to NOAA's annual June luncheon. I'm Marjorie Fisher, president of NOAA, and I'm delighted to see all of you. We have today a program from the pediatrician and the grandmother. The pediatrician is Dr. Robert Mendelson, a member of NOAA's Professional Advisory Board and an author of numerous books. He has, among them, he has written Confessions of a Medical Heretic and How to Have a Healthy Child. And then we have also Barbara Saxel, who is really the inspiration for the founding of NOAA. Those of you who have been members for some time will know that the history of our organization began with a class which Barbara gave at the Y in Highland Park on nutrition, and her textbook was Roger J. Williams' Nutrition Against Disease, and the class enjoyed it so much that they said, we just can't stop. And well, we have Jane, our founding president, and we have a number that have been active ever since, and the organization has grown tremendously because people are so interested in the relationship between nutrition and health. And now it is my very great honor to introduce for you the pediatrician and the grandmother.
Can the grandmother go first?
Yes.
Just this morning, I was told not to follow Bob Mendelson as a speaker. Only a fool would do that. And I prefer to think that I'm dedicated and not foolish. At any rate, I'm just going to say one word. Stay up here, Bob. I just want to say that I was billed with Bob on radio as the grandmother in the pediatrician and the grandmother. He didn't qualify for that. Now, Bob.
Let's see if I can. Maybe.
You're gonna
well,
have to
thank you.
And I'm going to have to stand up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. First, I would like to congratulate the outgoing president. And congratulations on two counts. Number one, on having been president. And number two, on having recovered so completely. And we're all grateful that in spite of all your medical care, you still recovered.
We're first rule, never cross the doctor, but I'm going to correct Bob because Margie has one more year, which we're all very grateful for, as president. We don't let our presidents off easily. They have to work for 2 years. May I also say that Mary Jane Revelle, our second NOAA president, is here from Oregon to be with us tonight. Would you stand, Mary Jane? And you see, this is to let you know that we've all endured.
And besides, it's a good idea to get out of Oregon these days with Mount St. Helens threatening to act up. So we're happy to have you in as quiet a place as Chicago, and particularly Winnetka. And Jane, I suppose that everybody owes you a debt of thanks for being the founding president of the organization, because NOAA is one of my favorite organizations. As a matter of fact, in the whole city of Chicago, in this whole metropolitan area, I don't know of any organization that I think does more good work than NOAA does. And so I'd like to congratulate all of you. And the other nice thing about NOAA is that I know that whenever I go with you people, I'm always going to go first class. Look at this gorgeous building that we're in today. And every time that we meet, it's always in the most elegant of surroundings. And therefore, I feel that NOAA is a wonderful combination of intellect and style. And I think both of those are important. I'm also very happy to extend my personal congratulations, Seymour and Iris, who have had a whole bunch of things to be happy about. A big trip earlier this year and now a grandchild. And you know, I've often said that one grandmother is worth two pediatricians. Now, I have to tell you, Seymour, when the chairman of my department heard me say that, he told me he was replacing me with two grandmothers.
Seymour can only handle one, though.
Seymour can only... So he said, I got great faith in Seymour. I also want to thank all of my friends who came out so early in the morning for this 9:30 luncheon. Yeah, I noticed that's what it was billed as. And as I walked in here, somebody said to me, well, Dr. Mendelsohn, I hope you're going to give us some hard facts today instead of just telling us jokes. So my charge has already been established. And I saw, when I walked in, a little baby. Oh.
Right on cue.
You can't claim I set that one up. And that makes me very happy, because I know that if a little baby is here, that that baby is being nursed. And as important as adult nutrition is, I don't think there's anything more important than the way you get started right at the beginning of life. As a matter of fact, when I was on the 700 Club, I don't know if any of you watched that program with Pat Robertson, he was talking to me about religion, and then he asked me, he said, Dr. Mendelsohn, I understand that you're in favor of home birth. And I said, yes. I said, with all due respect to your audience, Pat, as important as it is to be born again, it's even more important to be born right the first time. So I've been interested in how mothers decide to nourish their little babies, because that has implications for life later on. The medical studies show that if you take a look at adults who were bottle-fed as babies, they have a higher incidence of hypertension, atherosclerosis, and obesity versus adults who were breastfed as babies. And I have developed such an antipathy to infant formula that if I see a baby being formula-fed, I feel that's a disgusting habit that should not be carried out in public. I think that if a woman wants to formula-feed her baby, she should go into the toilet to do that. I'm very, very happy, Seymour and Iris, because Rita and I now have 5 grandchildren, and of course part of the reason for that is because we're so much older than you are. And I have to tell you people that our grandchildren were all born at home, because we don't take from hospital obstetrics, which puts you at risk from a nourishment standpoint right at the beginning. Because if you go into the hospital to have your baby, the doctor is likely to put an intravenous line into your arm which contains sugar. And he will take a mother who is so careful of what she eats that she never lets sugar pass her lips, and he will inject sugar directly into her veins, which goes through the placenta into the baby, setting up originally a state of hyperglycemia, too much blood sugar, which is followed by reactive hypoglycemia, too little blood sugar. And all of you know that hypoglycemia can be damaging to the central nervous system. And that's why I recommend for anybody who has to have their baby in the hospital to say to the doctor, but doctor, I don't eat sugar. Why would you give me sugar by vein? And see how he handles that question. And then, of course, you have to ask the doctor a whole bunch of other questions. And particularly if you're a woman, because women stand at much greater risk from doctors than men do, because doctors don't spend as much time with women. All the medical studies show that doctors spend 2 to 3 times as much time with their male patients as with their female patients, which is why I always tell women that when you go to a doctor, take a man along with you, and preferably a couple of men. You know. And then see if... See if they will challenge the doctor with the tough questions. I even have prescriptions for men if they're present in the delivery room. Because one of the things that doctors love to do, as a matter of fact, they have had it mandated into state law, is they love to put those dangerous eye drops, silver nitrate or antibiotic eye drops, into the eyes of newborn babies. And I tell a mother, oh, the reason why they do that, I suppose you know, is because they assume that every mother in this country has gonorrhea. That's the only reason for those eye drops, in order to save the baby from catching gonorrhea from the mother. So I tell mothers that when the doctor comes at your baby with those eye drops, you should say to him, "But doctor, I didn't have gonorrhea when I came into your delivery room." And if that doesn't work, then the husband should say something, because the reason for the husband being in the delivery room is to protect his wife and baby. And he should say, "Doctor, are you insinuating that my wife has a venereal disease?" And then see how the doctor reacts, especially if the husband is a tough-looking guy. Well, I want to briefly...
I have a word to say.
Oh, please.
All right, just wondering.
Once I get started, you're in lots of trouble.
I've got a good elbow. He's also too tall for me. It seems to me that the mother who hasn't the courage or can't convince the doctor about the nitrate, silver nitrate drops might have had some defense against them for her baby if she'd been on a good program prenatally. I think it's fairly well established that vitamin E prenatally is offers some protection against the kind of damage that is done by the silver nitrate drop. Is that true, Bob?
I think that not only vitamin E, but vitamin C and a whole bunch of other things.
Well, there should be an entire program. But vitamin E particularly, I think, is effective against the damage that's done to the retina of the eye by those drugs.
And you know, people have to be so careful, because the doctor might prescribe aspirin for the mother. And how many mothers know, or fathers, that aspirin interferes with vitamin C metabolism?
People in this room will know now.
Well, I should hope so. As a matter of fact, I brought along a book because I usually try to recommend some reading material. And this time, since the title of my talk, of our talk, was Defending Your Good Health, and that title interested me because I had to figure out, what are you defending your good health against? And you see, for me, that's no problem.
We
because,
knew you'd
because,
figure
because
that
since,
one out.
Since I think the doctors are a major cause of disease, I came up with the answer that you have to defend yourself against your doctor.
And your poor diet and pollutants in the air and a number of other things.
So the book that I brought along is not a new one. It's the 10th anniversary of Daphne Rowe's book called Drug-Induced Nutritional Deficiencies. And I intend, as we go along today, to read you little excerpts from this book. But let me just tell you that if any of you are taking any drugs, antihypertensives, antiarthritics, anticonvulsants, antibiotics, the birth control pill, tetracycline, whatever, this book will tell you precisely from the medical journals how those drugs interfere with the absorption of certain items of nutritional value in your diet. So I'd like to recommend Daphne Rowe's book. Yes? Yes, the author is Daphne Rowe, R-O-E, and I know you can still get it because I still recommend it to medical students. The publisher is AVI, Publishing Company. And Daphne Rowe is professor of the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University at Ithaca, New York. Now, some of you may remember Cornell because that was the place where one of the most famous nutritional studies was ever carried out. That's where they took the animals and divided them into two groups. And the first group, they fed the cereal inside the boxes. And the second group, they fed the boxes. And the second group outsurvived the first group. And that was one of the major studies. And a lot of good studies have come out of Cornell, many of them as a result of Daphne Rowe's work. Did you want to say something, or should I go ahead?
No, go right ahead.
Oh. I wanted to share with you my own background in nutrition. Because I have to tell you that I knew nothing about nutrition in my developing years. In the first place, I never went to a nursery school or a daycare center because I never heard of them in those days, which meant that I never received any snacks. And when I went to grammar school, which was in Chicago, at Budlong Grammar School on Foster Avenue, we used to go home for lunch. And we would get out of school at 10 to 12, and we wouldn't come back until 10 after 1, and everybody went home for lunch. I can remember even the children from the institutions, from Lawrence Hall and Chapin Hall, they used to go home for lunch too. And so I didn't learn anything about nutrition. And I thought it was normal for everybody to go home for lunch, because in those days, everybody used to have a mother or another relative who was waiting for them to come home. When I went to high school at Roosevelt High School, I also didn't learn anything about nutrition, because we all brought our own lunch. And you brought your lunch in a brown paper bag, or for those who were fancier, they had those little metal lunch boxes, and you couldn't not eat your mother's lunch, because that was a sin. And so everybody ate it, or at least you traded it with somebody else. And some people went through the cafeteria lines, but not very many. And so all during grammar school and high school, I learned nothing about nutrition. I learned a little bit when I went to college down at the University of Chicago, because the first year I decided to live on campus, and that meant that I had to take care of finding my own food, and that got to be such a chore that the second year I moved back home, and I commuted after that from the north side to the south side, and I think that's how I managed to get through school, because at least there was enforced study time on the elevated trains during my commute. Then I was drafted into the U.S. Navy, and that's how I got to be a doctor, because I was an English major in college. But when I went into the U.S. Navy, they asked me what I wanted to do, and I told them that I wanted to go into radar, because radar was the glamour specialty of the time. And they gave me the test, and I failed it. And they gave it to me a second time. I failed it twice. Then the Navy gave me an aptitude test, and that's how I got into medicine. Now, I don't hold the U.S. Navy responsible for anything that's happened ever since, but I'm very grateful to them. In the Navy, I learned a little about institutional food, and I didn't get a chance to repeat my Navy food until I became an intern and a resident in a hospital. And then the food was the same, because that was the kind of food that doctors think is good food. If you ask a doctor, what should I eat? His answer is, just eat a well-balanced diet. And if you want to find out what a doctor thinks a well-balanced diet is, all that you have to do is to look at hospital food, or the food of any institution that is created by doctors and by registered dietitians, because many of them believe that junk food is a good thing for you. As a matter of fact, medical schools for many years did not teach nutrition. But in the last couple of years, due to public pressure, they are now beginning to teach nutrition.
How many hours of nutrition?
Oh, it's not just how many hours of nutrition, it's the quality of the teaching. Because 2 years ago, I had a chance to serve as the keynote speaker for the National Convention of the American Medical Students Association, and I asked them what their nutrition courses were like. And they are learning nutrition from the people who I refer to as the junk food trio: Philip White from the American Medical Association, Victor Herbert from New York and now from Philadelphia, and Fred Stair from Harvard. And those are the people who tell you that junk food is okay. So my argument is that it would be better not to teach the medical students nutrition, because since medical schools cannot seem to teach doctors anything else, why should we trust them to teach doctors about food? So my bottom line is that if you're interested in good nutrition, do not ask your doctor about food, because he has had no education in nutrition. Instead, ask him a few questions to see if he knows as much as you do. One famous doctor recently said that when it comes to nutrition, the average doctor knows about as much as his receptionist, unless his receptionist is on a diet, and then she knows more. Ask your doctor, has he read Carlton Fredericks or Michio Kushi or Paavo Airola or Dale Alexander or Roger Williams Or any of the or let's go back further, Adele Davis or Bernard McFadden, who 25 and 50 years ago were saying what the AMA and the American Cancer Society are finally starting to say today. They were telling us that a high fiber diet is a good idea and that sugar is a bad thing. And they said that all those years ago. And now finally, the American medical establishment, at least in part, is beginning to catch up with them. So I recommend that if you go to a doctor for nutritional advice, you should ask him first whether he has read the same books as you have. And if he hasn't, then you know that he is not a proper source of nutritional advice. Now, that's particularly true at the beginning of life. You may have noticed that pediatricians in the last 2 years have changed their advice about solid foods. They used to tell you to introduce solid foods at a month or two of age, and they would say, give the baby a little cereal or a little banana or whatever. As a matter of fact, my idea of a pediatrician is somebody who's in the delivery room, and as the baby emerges from the birth canal, the pediatrician takes a hot dog and sticks it into his mouth. But now, the pediatricians have finally caught up with the La Leche League, and now they're telling mothers that they should totally nurse the baby until 6 months of age. However, that doesn't mean that they've learned very much, because if you say to a pediatrician, I plan to breastfeed my baby, the first thing he says is, oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because breast milk is nature's perfect food. But then he quickly adds, not quite. Because you have to give the breastfed baby vitamin C and vitamin D and fluoride drops, because he still thinks that God made a whole bunch of mistakes. As a matter of fact, pediatricians in general believe that God made a mistake when he didn't put Enfamil or Similac into women's breasts. Just like obstetricians these days, with their 29% cesarean section rate across the country, have apparently decided that God made a mistake when he didn't put a zipper into women's bellies. And so that's why I tell people that when it comes to nutrition, you have to be very, very suspicious of doctors. The pediatrician, if I can carry this on through the cycle of life, then says to the mother, go ahead and buy some of the manufactured, commercially available baby foods, which, of course, is a bad idea. I once was approached by Beechnut because they, together with the other food manufacturers, were caught in a scandal, and they figured that they had to take all of that stuff out of their baby foods. So they came to me and they said, we want to take out the MSG and the salt and the sugar and the starch, and they wanted to take everything out. And then they wanted to put out a new line of baby foods, which would be endorsed by me. They wanted to call it Dr. Mendelsohn's Baby Foods. So I wasn't against that. And after 3 conversations, I said to them, okay, now it's time for me to look at your plant in Canna Joharie, New York. But they wouldn't let me into the plant. And so that was the end of my endorsement of Beechnut. So, and I know why they wouldn't let me into the plant. They wouldn't let you into the plant either, because then you would get a chance to look at the allowances that the government sets for various kinds of debris that can be introduced into the manufacturing process. So that's how the pediatrician can be dangerous to the baby in the second half of the first year. Later on, doctors can be very dangerous, because they tell you that there's nothing wrong with sugar or white flour or additives or preservatives or any kind of chemicals. As a matter of fact, right now, with the proposed irradiation of food supplies, the doctors are assuring us that radiation of food is perfectly all right. And I understand that assurance, because how can a doctor tell you that irradiation of your food is no good when he is zapping you with x-rays all the time? Now, there were a few advances in the last few years in the field of x-rays. 2 years ago, the American College of Radiology came out in agreement with me against the routine annual chest x-ray. And my own organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, came out against the routine admission x-rays of children when they enter hospitals. You might think we're making progress. Don't be so sure about that, because One of the rules is that doctors never give up one dangerous procedure unless they have an even more dangerous one waiting in the wings. So while doctors have appeared to have given up these routine x-rays, they have now turned to the CAT scan. And I suppose you know that 232 Johnson & Johnson CAT scanners last year had to be removed from the market because they were recycling automatically. When you push the button, instead of the patient getting one exposure, he got eight exposures. Instead of the patient getting x-ray diagnosis, he received x-ray treatment. And in addition to the CAT scan, there's now this new machine, which was originally called NMR. Has anybody heard of it? Nuclear magnetic resonance. And now they don't like the word nuclear because they think that'll frighten people. So they changed it to MRI, which stands for magnetic resonance imaging, because they're hoping that people won't be as frightened by that, even though the machine itself already carries a warning that it is not supposed to be used in pregnant women, because no one has determined the effect of those rays, even though they're not ionizing radiation, no one has determined their effect on the growing fetus. And the reason why that's important for all of us, even if we're not pregnant, is because there's a rule in medicine. I'll give it to you in Greek and then in English. The rule is, mutagenicity is related to carcinogenicity. English translation, the ability of a substance to create congenital malformations is related to its ability to create cancer. And since one out of three of us, according to the statistics, is destined to die from cancer, everybody is very interested in seeing what the role of the doctor is in contributing to the cancer mortality.
Can I give a rule of nutrition that might temper a little of the dangers of x-ray if you must, or CAT scans if you must? And I think it's pretty well established that the antioxidants offer a very good measure of protection if taken before and immediately after you've had x-ray or any of that type of treatment. The antioxidants include vitamin C, and of course that comes up in any discussion of health defenders. Vitamin C is probably the major one. Vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, particularly in the form of beta carotene, the minerals zinc and selenium, possibly manganese, some amino acids, and some assorted nutrients, all gathered under the heading of antioxidants. I think if you must have x-ray or if you must be subject to nuclear medicine, we can still say that here. And it might be a good idea to defend yourself with some type of nutritional therapy like that beforehand.
Yeah, and let me expand on that, because I'm glad you brought that up. I forgot to include that. Yeah, I forgot to include that in my story. There are at least three ways in which you can protect yourself against x-rays, in addition to the fourth way of not getting them taken. Leave out the foods, like the dark green leafy vegetables and kale and broccoli and things like that, that have been shown to be protective against the effect of x-rays. The second method is the macrobiotic method, and that was demonstrated at the time of the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombings, that the people who were on the macrobiotic diet had a much lower incidence of damage from radiation from the atomic bombs. And if anybody wants the documentation for that, the name of the book is The Book of Macrobiotics. The author is Michio Kushi, and I would bet that you have some macrobiotics books in your libraries. You see, my argument these days is that the best place to go for advice on medicine is not to the doctor's office, but to the books that are on the shelves of the health food stores, because there you can get books that are hard to find anywhere else. Yes? Well, let me just, before I answer that question, before Barbara does, let me mention the third substance. And the reason why I'm interested in the third product is because even though I've looked at a whole bunch of products that have been brought to me for endorsement, I have never in my life endorsed a product until now, this month. And the way that came about was this. Everybody who comes to me for an endorsement gets asked the same two questions. Number one, have you done scientifically controlled studies, both experimental and human, to show that the substance is effective? And number two, have you done toxicity studies to show from the toxicologic standpoint that the substance is safe? And so far, nobody who's come to me has had those studies available. Now somebody came to me with those studies. There's a product that's put out in Switzerland, which I'm sure most of you have never heard of, called Biostrath. And Biostrath is a yeast substance. And what they did at the University of Zurich was to take groups of rats. They divided them in half. Half they gave the Biostrath, the other half they gave a dummy substance. And they then irradiated the rats. And they showed a difference in their survival times and in their fertility rates. And that's the first time that anybody has ever done a controlled study. Now in this country, since universities and medical schools seem to be more interested in testing drugs than they do in testing food supplements, those kinds of studies have not been done. So that's another possibility. Now in terms of dosage, I'm going to turn that over to Barbara, although I'm perfectly happy to talk about that. But you see, whenever patients ask me what dose should I take, I always send them to Barbara because she's become my consultant. And someday they're going to arrest you for practicing medicine without a license, I hope.
I have to give you my usual answer about that. You ate too well as a youth. You're too tall for me. I think that any supplementation is highly individual. And if you're already taking adequate amounts of the antioxidant, the only one I think I would suggest you might want to step up to much more than adequate amounts would be vitamin C. If you have to take a really large amount of vitamin C and are troubled by the acidity of it, you might at that point take a buffered C, which is much easier to take in large amounts. But I think you can go sky high on vitamin C as long as it's buffered and just adequately high in the others.
Well, let me say another word about dosage because that question comes up so often. People say, how much C, E, zinc, calcium should I take? And yet they trust the doctor to know the dosage of his drugs. If you look up the prescribing information in the physician's desk reference for most of the doctor prescribed drugs, you will see that the dosage is highly irregular. And you'll see, for example, that a lot of drugs, the antiarthritics, for example, butazolidine, which you can't get at the racetrack, you know, you can't give bute to horses, but you can give butazolidine to people, or Motrin, or Indocin, or Naprosyn, or Anaprox, Feldene, or the ones that have been withdrawn from the market, Tanderil and Oriflex, all carry a warning that says, for older patients, the dose should be lowered. And then you go to the drug company and you say to them, how much should the dose be lowered? And they don't know the answer. You see, because nobody's tested these things out. And they say these things. And so I think the dosage is such a tricky thing, whether it has to do with nutritional substances or with drugs, that the responsibility of the patient is to do two things. The first is to read up on dosage as much as he can. Earl Mindell's The Vitamin Bible, Nick Bosco's Vitamins from A to Zinc, and then at the same time to use themselves as the experiment. Try the stuff and see if it makes you feel better. And if it does, then you can pretty well guess what the dosage is, because the guesses of all of us are exactly that. They're guesses. We may dress up the guesses by calling them clinical judgment, but they still remain guesses.
I think Because you mentioned medication and dosages, Bob has recommended a couple of books. I have one I think I would like to recommend that you familiarize yourselves with, and that's the PDR, the Physician's Desk Reference. If you do have to take a drug or a prescription, it would be wise to either bulldoze your pharmacist into giving you the full disclosure that should accompany every one of those prescriptions, or go to the library and look up the drug in the Physician's Desk Reference. If you ever leaf through it on a rainy afternoon, you might just think it's going to be the next Steven Spielberg horror movie. But it is a good thing to know about and to use.
Yes, and in addition to the Physician's Desk Reference, which is now available in every public library in the country,
yeah,
things have changed since the 1960s, because now there is no reason for a patient not to know the truth about their drug. There's no point in asking your doctor, because you know his answer is going to be, just trust me. Unless you're a woman, then it's just trust me, dear. And if you come to the doctor with information that is at variance with the information a doctor has given you, then he says, what medical school did you go to? So I don't bother around with the doctors anymore. And you can't get the information from the pharmacist because he's too scared of the doctor. If the doctor finds out that he's been leaking the secret data to you, I mean, you know, you might find yourself arrested by the government or something for conducting a spy operation. So I tell people that in addition to the PDR, you can also get the AMA Drug Evaluations book, which is in most public libraries. Or you can get Joe Graydon's The People's Pharmacy, or the Handbook of Prescription Drugs. Now, let me come back to this dosage problem in regard to supplements. And I'll tell you how the dialogue should go. Let's say that you say to me, how much calcium should I take? Then I have to answer you with a question. I have to say, how much phosphorus are you taking? Because everybody knows that what's important is the ratio of calcium to phosphorus. And we all know that that antibiotics, for example, tetracycline, increases your phosphorus load. And therefore, you may have to take more calcium than the prescribed dose. That's right, the cola drinks and a whole bunch of other soft drinks will increase your phosphorus load. And then you have to ask, how much magnesium are you taking? Because maybe if you took a little more magnesium, even a small amount of calcium would be adequate. The favorite question that I get all the time is, what do I do? My kids won't drink milk. And now there's two books that I recommend. One of them is 10 Years Old by Dr. Frank Oski, professor of pediatrics at Upstate New York University at Syracuse. The name of his book is Don't Drink Your Milk, and he tells you how bad milk is for children. And the second book, just out, is by Dr. William Douglas from Atlanta, Georgia, and the name of his book is The Milk of Human Kindness is Not Pasteurized. Now, what he did was he took Frank Oski's stuff, where Oski came out against milk for a whole bunch of reasons, and he added the new information on the dangers that are now being recognized from pasteurized, homogenized milk, which, of course, all of us are exposed to, because in the state of Illinois, the doctors are so powerful that you cannot get raw certified milk in this state. All right, now let me go on to the next point.
I just wanted to ask you, please, if you wouldn't recommend just taking two tums.
Just taking
the popular recommendation from doctors, just take two tums.
Oh yeah.
And the fallacy there.
Well, please? Sure. Yeah. Let me mention them again. I mentioned the Physician's Desk Reference, and I mentioned the AMA earlier than that. Oh, yes, yes. I mentioned two books by friends of mine. Earl Mindell's book, the name of it is The Vitamin Bible. He's now got a new one out called The Vitamin Bible for Children, which I presume you read when you're in Hebrew school on Sunday mornings or something. And the second book is is Vitamins from A to Zinc by Dominic Bosco, B-O-S-C-O. Yes? I say no. What do you say? Am I wrong?
Well, I work with so many people. I have experience one-on-one, and I find that some people who really don't tolerate milk well can tolerate yogurt. But for many, that isn't true. If you have a real milk intolerance, you probably would do better getting your acidophilus in supplemental form and not eating yogurt at all.
I have another answer for that, which is that a lot depends on your cultural background. For example, if you take minority groups in this country, they can satisfy their needs without all of their nutritional needs without resorting to milk in any form, yogurt included. Let me give you some classic examples. If you take the classic black diet of chitlins and collard greens, it satisfies all your protein, calcium, and other nutritional requirements. If you take the traditional Mexican diet of beans and tortillas, it's a completely nutritional diet. If you take the Orientals, they don't drink, at least the first generation of Orientals in this country, and those in the Orient, do not drink fresh whole cow's milk, because the Orientals have a 95% incidence of lactase deficiency, which means that they have trouble digesting fresh whole cow's milk. So they drink either buttermilk or milk that sat around for 3 or 4 days. So a lot depends not only on your individual status, but on your cultural background, which is why I usually feel that for us Jews, the most important thing is probably lox and bagels. I want to get back to this calcium phosphorus thing, because I think it is so important for us to rethink about milk. And one of my favorite examples was the recent salmonella epidemic. I mean, here we had, 15,000 cases. 15,000 cases of salmonella that came from not raw milk, but came from pasteurized, homogenized milk, which I understand the company is now trying to blame on some raw milk that leaked into it through a secret channel that nobody's been able to identify. So when I see moves in the state legislatures and the federal Congress to get rid of raw certified milk on the grounds that it contains salmonella, I have a hunch that from now on, those forces are going to have a much harder time making their case now that we know that the biggest epidemic of salmonella in human history, right in our state of Illinois, in the city of Chicago, came from pasteurized, homogenized milk, checked at all steps. Did you want to say anything about that salmonella thing?
I would like to, because I think it points up what we're talking about today, about defending our health. I had occasion to work with a lot of families where there was victims of salmonella poisoning, and it was interesting to see that among the families where a child had had antibiotics in recent months, that child became the heaviest victim and the sickest. So it's very important as a defense against that sort of thing to have a good Acidophilus population in the intestinal tract. The child who was in a family of four, two children had had antibiotics, both were hospitalized. The other two children in that family who had not had antibiotics, but who had had at least as much milk, remained well, and one only modestly sick. Again, I think that the state of your health when you're exposed to this kind of epidemic is what makes a difference. It just goes back to the immune system. I often think if we were in this room, someone dropped a bomb in this room, the ones who survive are the lucky ones. But if in this room we were all exposed to the same plague, the ones who survive would be the ones with a good immune system, or those who had a good nutritional background who were healthy. And I think that goes with the salmonella or any of the other exposures we get.
I hope everybody in this room knows, in relationship to the Salmonella epidemic, that of the three fatalities, two of them have been treated with antibiotics. Because the recipe for making a Salmonella victim worse is to give them an antibiotic. Since those germs, I suppose you know, have now been referred to in medicine as super germs, and they have figured out how to thrive on the antibiotic. So if you want an explosion of bacterial activity, you give a patient suffering from Salmonella an antibiotic. So those fatalities from that epidemic were caused not by the Salmonella, but by the treatment. And they're going to be litigated in court one of these days. Yes. I don't know it. Who is it? With American Council on Applied Nutrition. Do you know the names of the people?
No.
Well, you see, let me tell you that it's important to know the names of the people, and let me identify the names that you have to know. I mentioned three already. I mentioned Fred Stair, Philip White, and Victor Herbert. Now, Victor Herbert is professor of nutrition. Victor Herbert is professor of nutrition at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And a lot of people have asked me what I think about him. My comment is that I think with a name like that, he should have stuck to music. But of course, he could always rejoin that with a name like mine, I should have stuck to music also. So I've given up on that. Now, there are a couple of other names that you should know about. The name Elizabeth Whelan, Whelan. Now, she's another one who believes that junk food is good for you. Another PhD. And there's another name, Stephen Barrett, who is an MD who complains about self-styled nutritionists. And when I testified before the Delaware State Legislature last month against this doctor, I pointed out that he is a self-styled psychiatrist, since he is not listed in the official directory of American specialists, but he calls himself a psychiatrist. So you have to watch for those names. I call it the rogues gallery of nutrition. So, because they pop up in these organizations, and you can't tell anything from the name of the organization. So if you can ever find out the names, and then if you want to contact me, I will be glad to give you an opinion.
Where are you, in Chicago?
Oh, yes. Let me give you my address, because some of you may want to write for my newsletter. It's Box 792, Evanston, and the zip is 60204. I put out a monthly newsletter. If anybody wants a free copy, just send me a stamped self-addressed envelope to that address. Do you know anything about that organization?
No, but I was going to say, we might mention some of the names to look for on the board of directors of those organizations, if those organizations contain the names of them.
It's affiliated with Clayton University, which is not an accredited school, but is recommended as a non-traditional degree.
Let me say something about that. You see, I got a hunch that you and I agree that we are not against non-accredited schools. Because you see, when it comes to education, I attribute whatever small degree of success I've enjoyed to the fact that I never had much education. Because you see, I already mentioned I never went to a daycare center, and I never even went to kindergarten or first grade, because it was during the Depression, and they gave us half-day education right through second grade. And then I became a patrol boy. And I would have to, I could get to school at 20 after 9 because I had to stand on the corner and allegedly help the children cross the street. And I got out of school at 20 to 12. And I had 20 minutes recess. So I didn't get too much education in grammar school. I spent my entire fourth year of high school working on the school yearbook. And when I went to the University of Chicago, it was during the Hutchins years when you did not have to attend class. And so I didn't attend class. So I have always subscribed to the Mark Twain school. Mark Twain once was asked, "Where did you get your education?" And he said, I have received my education during my entire life except for the years I attended school. So I'm always interested in unaccredited places. Victor Herbert complains because his dog got a degree from Donsbach University. You know, he sent in the money and the lessons or whatever it was, and his dog got a degree. And he thinks that's a bad thing. And my answer is, I think the more important question is, who gives the better nutritional advice, Victor Herbert or his dog? Yes.
I'd like to ask you this question. Our present administration is deregulating a lot of the work of the regulating agencies. Do we, the public, have cause for concern about protection that?
Well, let me give you my answer to that. It's based on how change takes place. Now, for example, you take the physician's desk reference. The physician's desk reference every year grows in size. It's now a huge book. It used to be a little narrow book because the manufacturers keep on listing additional side effects from drugs. Now, why do they do that? They don't do that simply because of government regulations. They do that in order to avoid lawsuits. Because you see, if a manufacturer tells the doctor that if the patient takes Forazine, for example, one of the major psychotropic tranquilizing drugs, that he can suffer from one of the most interesting side effects in medicine, sudden death, you see, then if a person dies, they will have trouble suing the drug company because the doctor knew about it and didn't tell the patient. So while I don't want to come out in favor of deregulation, I have a feeling that there are still enough protections in that marketplace for the consumer and for the lawyer. The problem right now is coming from people who are trying to restrict the malpractice actions against both doctors and against drug companies. I don't know if that responds to your question or not. I have been watching that with great interest because, you see, my argument is that I don't need the FDA for enforcement. I need the FDA for publicity. And the FDA drug bulletin is so marvelous. The only problem with it is that it only goes out to health professionals. I'll give you one quick example of the latest drug bulletin. Has anybody here seen in the newspapers the information about that new kidney stone crushing machine, which of course, since it cost, I don't know, $50,000 or $100,000, the doctors would never call it a stone crusher. They turned to Greek and call it a lithotripter, which is Greek for stone crusher. And they tell you that the stone crusher is a magnificent thing and it's going to do away with surgery. Has everybody seen that kind of well, the FDA drug bulletin just came out with the downside of the stone crusher. It turns out that when they put you in that bathtub full of water, they first have to anesthetize you. They give you general, spinal, or epidural anesthesia. How many of you knew that? When they start bombarding you with the sound waves, they have to protect your lung because those ultrasound waves can cause damage to the lung tissue, and they're supposed to put styrofoam around your lung. Number three, there's a whole bunch of patients who are not supposed to get lithotripter treatment. If you have what they call, quote, excess fat, I'd love to know what they mean by that. You talk about dosing, I'd love to know. You're not supposed to take lithotripter treatment. If you have gallstones, if you have kidneys, if you have stones in the lower part of the ureter, and there's a number of other contraindications. I wonder how many people know that one of the complications of lithotripter treatment is a collection of blood, a blood clot known as a hematoma around the kidney. So, you see, from the information that is already available, if the public can get to it, we can have plenty of protection. The problem right now, as I see it, is not a shortage of information, but a gap in communications. Because the doctor stands between you and the information. If you want to come back to nutrition, I come back to my favorite subject, calcium. And I move to the other end of life instead of talking about children. What does the doctor say to older folks, particularly women? He says, you're going to get osteoporosis and a dowager's hump and your vertebrae will collapse unless you take Premarin. And then, or another postmenopausal hormone. And then a woman says, oh, but doctor, can't I just take calcium? And the doctor says, well, that doesn't work. You better take Premarin in addition to the calcium. And then the woman says, but doctor, it says here that Premarin, in the physician's desk reference or anywhere else, that Premarin can lead to cancer of the breast, the uterus, and the ovaries. Then the doctor says to her, well, you don't have to worry about the uterus and the ovaries because I already did a hysterectomy on you. So all you have to worry about is the breast. And doctors will use female sex hormones on older women just like they use female sex hormones in the form of oral contraceptives on younger women rather than turning to calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, and other substances which you and I both know can prevent and can treat osteoporosis.
And when the doctor does prescribe calcium, he often says just take 2 tums, but there's a big fallacy there because, oh my goodness, we've got a lot of questions there, because tums are a very poor source of calcium, no magnesium with them, which is, Bob says, is highly important. And also they're very alkaline. It's very difficult to be able to use calcium from an alkaline source. They also have the mistaken notion that they're 500 milligrams of calcium. They're not. They're 500 milligrams of calcium carbonate, which is really only about 40% calcium. So it's very poor prescribing if you've been told to use Tums as a calcium supplement. We have a lot of questions here about, here is one about calcium. And
what is the way to discover the proper balance among phosphorus, calcium, etc.? Well, the best way to do that is to read the books. The books that I mentioned will tell you what the calcium-phosphorus ratio should be and what it is of different foods. Now, if you want to determine it in your own body, the doctor can always carry out, or you don't even need a doctor. You can go to a chemical laboratory, a biochemical laboratory, and they will carry out tests on your blood of calcium and phosphorus, and you'll have a chance to get a measurement, understanding that that is a very rough measurement because of the error rate in blood tests. And here I recommend another book for any of you who are faced with any of the tests at the hands of doctors. Since tests now account for 50% of all medical costs in this country, I recommend that before anybody goes for a test, they get a hold of a book called A Patient's Guide to Medical Testing. And the author of the book is Dr. Ed Pinckney, P-I-N-C-K-N-E-Y. The publisher of the book is Facts on File, and it's one of the best sources of error rates and complications of the doctor's tests. The next question, what is your opinion of beta blockers and calcium blockers? Well, I'm very interested in those drugs like Inderol, or another one is called Procardia. How can you argue with a drug that is named to be in favor of the heart? And can you imagine anybody naming a drug Anticardia? I tell anybody who's on those drugs that they have to look up the side effects, particularly the sexual side effects. Because if you're on Inderol, if a man is on Inderol and he finds out that one of the important side effects of Inderol is impotence and loss of sexual vigor, he might go to the doctor and say, doctor, you never told me, and now this drug for my high blood pressure has ruined my sex life and is destroying my marriage. Then the doctor gives him what I call the voodoo curse of medicine. He says, would you rather have a stroke? You see, because the doctor doesn't know how to treat these conditions except through drugs. Now, I have to give you the latest information which I brought along with me on some of the drugs that the doctor uses for the heart and blood vessels. Did anybody want me to mention anything other than Inderol and Procardia or any of the others? Because there's a whole bunch. Yes?
Cardesium.
That's another one. It's in the same category as Procardia. Pardon me?
Tenormin.
Tenormin is another one. These are all the beta blockers.
My experience has been the patients I've seen that were on calcium blockers were invariably deficient in magnesium, and it was unrecognized, and what they were really treating was a magnesium deficiency.
That's very interesting. I appreciate that, Tom. Let me just give you the prescribing information for one of the favorite drugs to lower serum cholesterol. There's now two drugs for serum cholesterol lowering. One of them is called Atrimed-S. And I take right from the American Medical Association, Journal of the American Medical Association. And at the bottom, there is a black-bordered box. And let me read to you what it says. It has not been established whether the drug-induced lowering of serum cholesterol has a detrimental, beneficial, or no effect on the mortality due to atherosclerosis or coronary heart disease, which means they don't know if the drug works. But on the other side,
please turn tape to side 2.